tree is going to look. So that's one problem, is that you can't just clearly identify economic damages. The other is the problem, if you clearly say all the economic damages are taken care of over here, then how do you say for one individual that these scars or this inability to speak and inability to do anything, you know, even to go to the bathroom, to do anything, how can you say that's worth $100,000 or $500,000? I have, in all respect to the legislature, you know, I have as much respect for the lay people, the 12 lay people that are going to come in and measure each case and make a judgment in that case, because I think it works as well as any system we can get. I don't think they're going to be more liberal than the judges, but I'd rather have 12 people than one.
I don't think anything can get more liberal than some judges, but that's... at any rate, when you look, let's say you got the economic considerations and you've taken care of presumably everything you could think of at the time, and then you look at the non-economic side of it. There's not been, if you look at the total awards that everybody's gotten, there hasn't been that many cases, I mean, you can count them, of $1 million or above $500,000 anyway.
That's right.
So of the ones we're talking about that would go into those gross figures of $500,000 to $1 million, the economic side would probably push them over that anyway. So the non-economic side of it, by capping that, we're not necessarily limiting those people effectively to preventing these $1 million awards that have been cited anyway.
I think,
and if that's what they're trying to get
I
at.
I think the case where the non-economic damages are actually awarded in Oregon that are over $500,000 are very, very rare. I agree with you. But I think there's justification because it's so hard to categorize these things. And secondly, in a particular case, as you point out, take the pain of living, and some of these people live, and you say, how much is that every day for a lifetime? $500,000 ain't much money. The other thing is the industry, I'm sure, would like you to put a limit on there. If you put even $1 million, whatever, they'd like a limit, because then they can start playing with that limit, and inflation will eat the limit up. And I remember when I was practicing law, when the limit on wrongful death is $25,000 in Oregon. We had a cap at that time. And it was a cruel thing. You'd give a widow $25,000, and that was the end of it. And I think, well, there are other instances. We've been talking here about injury cases. Wrongful death may be another one where it's difficult to distinguish between economic and non-economic. And the teaching, supervision of a father, mother of a child, and all that, you have enormous value, and yet there's no way you can really put a clear dollar sign on it. I think it's going to affect negotiation of cases in a lot. There's no question of that. They would want it for that reason.
Well, okay, I don't want to, because I do want to hear what you had on the joint several, but it seems to me that this cap isn't going to stop the $1 million awards that come, the few of them, and there's relatively few anyway. It's going to affect the settlement process, 96% of the cases that are settled rather than go to final disposition by the court, more than anything else. Mm-hmm. If I'm reading behind these folks that come in here and say we want some kind of a structure there to base everything off of, what they really want is a negotiating tool that when the plaintiff's attorney comes in, the defense attorney has, you know, can always have a fallback place to bargain down from.
If you have a 500 limit, they'll never pay the 500 limit. They'll say, hey, that's the most you're going to get if you go to court, so we'll offer you half.
Well, only on non-economic, but at least this is the negotiating side of it that we're really affecting more than anything else. Is that accurate?
I think you'd affect the negotiating side of it very great with that very much, no doubt about it. And it may, in my own experience, in my own office, I think it would require more cases to go to trial. I don't think it would cause us to settle. I think we'd say, okay, we're going to try it. And in some of these other changes, we've done some analysis and read it, and we think we'll be trying more cases rather than settling more in the future if these changes are made.
One other, if you have an analysis of the bill, I mean, the other side, Seals, gave us gave me, I don't know if they gave these three guys, an analysis section by section. If you had that, I'd really appreciate getting that, if your firm has done that or you have done that.
I haven't done something in writing. We've looked at these provisions. For example, the question of caps, and we've discussed, is that going to settle more cases, going to make more cases tried? We think it's going to make more cases tried. The same with the joint and several provision. If that's adopted, no question in my mind, it's going to be more cases are tried rather than settled, as far as we're concerned.
Well, I didn't mean to digress, but it was kind of hot since
sure.
they had just...
No, I appreciate it.
Excuse me.
Mr. Johnson, just one question and further digression. There's been some discussion along the lines of product liability and how that's going to affect an individual perhaps who doesn't have the economic damages but clearly has suffered a loss due to a defective product. And I was just curious, I know you've had some experience with product liability cases where there hasn't been as the clear economic loss versus the pain and suffering that's gone with damage to an individual's body due to a defective product.
Yeah, I was going to touch on that, and I'll mention it now. One case I handled where a woman suffered toxic shock syndrome from the use of a superabsorbent tampon, a Neprilyne case. Actually, this case was in Arizona. But in that case, it was difficult. We had a lot of economic damage. But here is a young mother of two very minor children. They were 5 and 3, and a husband who was worked in a very well-skilled machinist. We had some economic damage because her loss of her job and some economic damage of having to take care of her and provide her wheelchair and that. The fact is, here is a woman that's confined to a wheelchair. She can't communicate with children anymore. She talked very much like the victim of cerebral palsy. She has severe brain damage, both motor function and it affects her ability to speech as well as some of her ability to think fully and to remember. And the children have no cause of action. The husband has a loss of consortium, which is worth something, but that loss of consortium, as far as economic damages, are taken care of in her claim. So while he had a wife who was a wonderful thing, I saw actually home movies of her before, a companion, a person full of life, a young mother, and sort of companion. You see that movie and you think you'd really like to know this woman. And here now he has an incredible burden. You know, he's fighting with his conscience. Can he continue to live with this creature that he's now has acquired? And he does live with her. He takes care of her and he takes her picnics and the kids and all that. But you're talking there about non-economic damages, as you are in a lot of wrongful death cases, and I just don't think that an arbitrary limit makes sense. Now, it does help with the negotiating process. But even that process, aren't you really saying you're forcing people to take less than they really ought to take? I mean, the settlement process ought to give a result consistent with what should be done to get full and fair compensation in law. And this is some of my concerns about the provision for joint and several liability. You know what the present Oregon law is. I'm always concerned when I hear people talk about joint several liability. I think it's grossly misunderstood. And you hear criticism that the present rule is some resourceful and new way for an injured party to reach some deep pocket as though there's something wrong with a person trying to get full and fair compensation. In fact, the rule is an old established rule. It's been with us hundreds of years. And basically it goes back just to the simple rule that if one is injured through the negligence or the fault of the other, the innocent victim is entitled to get full and fair compensation from the wrongdoer. Okay, if it's got one injured person and one wrongdoer, that's simple. We got two wrongdoers now. The rule is simply that you're entitled to get your full compensation from either one, provided that the defendant wasn't just, as they say, 1% at fault. The rule is substantially contributed to causing that injury. And I don't think any jury has ever given the verdict that I've seen for 1% at fault. They must find under the law and under the instructions that the defendant's wrongful conduct was a substantial factor in causing the injury. I think that's more meaningful to a jury than to talk about percentage. It's a substantial factor in causing the injury. So if one is 80% at fault and the other is 20% at fault, it's reasonable and it's proper under the law now that either one has to pay the full damages, and then they can quarrel between themselves under the contribution statute to allocate that amount of damages. And you come then to the question, well, you have, let's say you've got three defendants, and the plaintiff, let's say the plaintiff is 35% at fault, and defendant one is 45% at fault, and defendant two is 20% at fault. In that instance, too, under the present statute, since the defendant two is less at fault than the plaintiff, he can only be held liable for his percentage of fault. That's the present law. And he can go back against the other one and get contribution. So the value, I think, of the present law, it does place the risk of the loss on the wrongdoer, not on the innocent victim. And it makes individuals, whether they're the plaintiff or the defendant, responsible for the conduct. And we continually hear that. Well, let's go back and have people responsible for their own conduct. That's exactly what the present Oregon law does. Now, you have the question that comes up. They talk about the deep pocket ideas. If you have three defendants and each one is one-third at fault and the negligence of each was a substantial factor in causing the injury to the plaintiff, what do you do about it? If, say, one of them is insolvent, either of the others would have to pay. And I just ask, is that unjust? I mean, is it unjust that a wrongdoer pay the full amount rather than an innocent plaintiff? If the plaintiff is partly at fault, his damages are reduced by the percentage of his fault anyway. So it seems it's reasonable that the wrongdoer suffers that risk. But SB 322 substantially changes the traditional rules. You know, it divides damages between economic and non-economic damages we've been talking about. And a defendant, as to non-economic damages, it would provide that the liability is several only and not joint, meaning that one defendant would be liable only for that proportion of non-economic damages equal to its percentage of fault. And as to economic damages, if a defendant is less than 10% at fault, such defendant's liability for economic damages will be several only. That doesn't sound too bad, but you've got to look at how it works in practice. First of all, it has some of these faults. It vastly complicates the trial process. Makes it more difficult to try the case. Makes it more difficult to instruct the jury. It's going to take more time to try the case. It's going to make it more difficult to settle the case. If we're going to be concerned with the judicial process, we should try to draft a bill that's going to simplify the process rather than complicate it. And again, I show you that suggest, since SB 323, that section is really talking about punitive, talking about damages, there's no showing that the traditional rule of joint several liability, that we need to amend it or change it. I think the witness earlier this afternoon, I think his figure suggested that joint several liability really was not a problem. The proposed measure will alter the function of the court in providing compensation to victims because some victims are not going to be fully compensated. And those victims then are going to have to turn to some other source for their support. I have clients who, because of their injury and disability, have to turn to public assistance. And when the award comes in, they go off public assistance permanently, and they pay back the public agency the money that has been furnished to them. But in more cases, if this bill goes through, they will not be able to make that recovery.
Excuse me, Representative Phillips.
I assume you're in your summary stage and you've moved off the joint several now, is that correct?
I'm in joint right.
Because I want to go back a little bit if I could.
I want to tell you a couple things about joint several later on, but okay.
Okay. Well, I'm just trying to, you went through how it mechanically would work under the new law, and I want to talk about that compared to the old law, because it seems we're meshing two different standards. The standard of, if he's a plaintiff and he's more at fault than I am, how does that relate when there's more than one defendant and we've set a threshold of 10%, 15%, 20%, and how would that work, and whether that in itself might create more litigation? I just wanted to.
Okay. I think you can set up scenarios with different percentages where it can get incredibly complex, I think. And the answers aren't in the bill as it's now written. I'll mention in a minute some of the ways that a 10% limit also complicates it. Well, I'll mention one, for example. Let's take 12 different companies dump TCE carcinogens into an improper landfill and poison water. The government has an enormous expense, the state of Oregon or the federal government, whichever one, will have enormous expense cleaning this toxic waste up. Individual plaintiffs have been poisoned by the bad water, and they have claims. But there were 12 of them that dumped in there. How do you prove that one of them is more than 10% at fault? In some of these toxic wastes, you have 50 or 60 different defendants have dumped in there. How do you prove any one of them is more than 10% at fault? Under this provision, the dumper is protected because you may never be able to prove that he is more than 10% at fault. And the government, the state of Oregon, or the person that has to clean up that waste may never be able to require the wrongdoer to pay for the price of the cleanup. And I think one of the main motivations of this kind of bill is to protect polluters and people that are created or have created toxic waste situations. And that's a hidden agenda. You don't hear much discussion about it. But those are the classic problems. You can almost, in most pollution situations, you have more than one polluter. And in the toxic waste situations, you normally have a number. And I think one of the other factors of this, I mean, that goes to sort of the public policy goals. It affects the ability of the court to do the kinds of things and to affect the kind of restraint on conduct that the court really does effectively do. And I'd like to give you a couple examples. It goes back to Representative Dix's question a minute ago. Let me give you one example of a case we were involved in, or three quick examples of how the law did have some effect on safety. In 1980, you'll remember in the summer of 1980, there was a sort of an epidemic of a new disease that appeared. No one had ever heard of it, toxic shock syndrome. And women were becoming severely ill everywhere. Women were dying. Women were being crippled. And it took months for the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta, Georgia, to pull together the statistics. First, they noticed, well, it was mostly women that were getting TSS. Then they noticed it was women of childbearing age. Then they began to discover, well, almost always it was a woman using a tampon. Eventually, they found a correlation between Rely, a new product put out by Procter & Gamble, a highly absorbent tampon made of artificial materials. The correlation seemed so real that Procter & Gamble, that had not properly tested that product before it was put on the market, and it put it on with just an incredible media blitz, did then act, I think, responsibly, and they pulled it off the market. Well, the two other major manufacturers of tampons, International Playtex and Tampax, immediately seized on that because they had been threatened by Procter & Gamble. It's a giant in the industry, and they've been threatened with this new Rely product, so they seized on it and filled the stores and came on with all the television advertising that their tampon was safe. And because Rely was all all of the Rely tampons were or artificial fibers, let's say. It's in here, carboxymethylcellulose and polyester. All of the Rely tampons were of that product, which is a bad product. So when they went off, the statistics dropped a lot, but we can continue to have a tremendous number of women getting ill and 9 to 12 dying every year. And the statistics were skewed because when we look over at Playtex and at Tampax, they had a whole range of products. They had the original tampons, were just normal cotton fiber, and some which were cotton and rayon, but rather simply changed rayon. But then they had some super absorbent tampons that they were purchasing, they were pushing, and they had polyacrylate rayon, highly processed chemical product, and some cross-linked carboxymethylcellulose in the slender regular. And so you continued to have some of these, but it took a long time to figure it out. We represented several women. I mentioned Mrs. Epperline was one. It was used a Tampax product. In Eugene, we represented Marion Altka. And since these kept occurring, we and the industry said, well, it's safe, relies off the market. It was very difficult to get the data to show it, but through extensive discovery and extensive depositions and that, we were able to show, with the help of a couple researchers in New York City, that the superabsorbent products that were in the Tampax fold and the Playtex fold were still very dangerous. And yet they were taking advantage of this market to continue to market them. They met the FDA requirements, because the FDA, for this kind of a product, all you have to do is do a filing and tell people what's in the product, basically, and what pre-market testing you've done. So we combined with some other attorneys and collaborated, particularly with one firm in Wichita, Kansas, Jerry Michaud and Mark Hutton. Our two cases were both set for trial at basically the same time. Theirs came on in February, fortunately, and ours was in April. But we prepared them together and worked closely together and worked with them during the trial of their case. That trial, which was a wrongful death of a young mother, Mrs. Ogilvy, in Wichita, resulted in a verdict of $10 million punitive damages. Okay? Everybody runs out, $10 million punitive damages. It's outrageous. It wasn't outrageous, and it served an incredibly useful function, because we proved in those cases that these defendants were continuing to use this despite clear knowledge that it was injuring and killing women, 9 to 12 in the country every year. And at the conclusion of that trial, the trial judge, Judge Kelly, who used to be a defense lawyer and is now a federal judge and as salty as can come, he said from the bench, I think this verdict is really saying, Playtex, take that damnable product off the market. You're killing people with it. Judge Kelly said that the verdict is no more than the voice of the community saying, stop it. Well, what happened then? Within 6 weeks, Tampax and Playtex had a recall. And these are published in the Eugene Register Guard and the Oregonian, and those are the recall. I brought copies of those for you for the record. That recall never would have occurred if people didn't have the right to go to court and to litigate in the traditional way. And if you didn't have a right to punitive damages, it probably wouldn't have done it either. Because a punitive damage issue, I might say, is still an appeal, but it's had the effect of getting the product off the market. Let me mention another example. An industrial elevator at Weyerhaeuser plant in Springfield met every standard for elevators that existed in the United States. And yet one day, a young woman who worked there rode the elevator. This is sort of a vertical conveyor belt with steps and handles on it. She rode up to the top and was carried over the top pulley and fell 55 feet to her death. The state of Oregon and other people came down, tested the elevator, and said, hey, this meets every safety standard we have. And yet we could go there and demonstrate that if you got on that elevator and you appeared to be frightened as you rode up floors and you hugged the belt, that you weight would be distributed in such a way that the safety device wouldn't work at all. And a cursory examination by the manufacturer at the beginning would have shown that. Because of the lawsuit, the standards were changed. Even after her death, the people from the state of Oregon came down and checked the elevator, said perfectly all right, put it back into operation. I mentioned the flammable pajamas. You heard about that in the testimony the other day. The material used in those pajamas has to pass a standard that was adopted in 1953. That standard, I can show you movies and films of it, of tests. Cotton tissue paper, a Kleenex, a newspaper, the Oregonian newspaper, you wouldn't think of making sleepwear for a child out of that kind of material. Because you'd imagine they might step up to a stove or they might step up to a fireplace and be caught in flames. And yet cotton flannel that will burn, the standard will pass these products, it will also pass this kind of cotton flannel. So although there's standards there, they're not adequate. I think too often we find that standards are really adopted by the industry itself, because they're the ones who have some knowledge of it, and they can come in and say, this is the standard, and people accept it. I suggest that any provision in this bill, like the joint and several, or anything that limits the opportunity to get punitive damages, will reduce the regulatory effect of the existing tort system, and will not only deny full compensation for injured victims, but will seriously reduce the level of safety afforded to consumers in the state. I mentioned about the rule of joint and several liability in respect to toxic poisoning and pollution control. I won't amplify on that, but I can show you a number of articles where people concerned with the subject think once you reduce it to 10% or something like that, these people have a free ride. And that doesn't affect just the right of the individual citizen who is poisoned by the pollution, but it affects the right of the federal government or the right of the state government to recover damages for the terribly expensive cleanup. Maybe I can answer some questions then.
Representative Phillips.
There was a bill over in the Senate that died, and I guess they stuck it in another form dealing with the third-party actions, and Mr. Gronzo was in time this week talking
Wednesday
talking about that. If you tie that to joint several liability changes and were to effectively change the practice, the third-party practice that's in statute now, would you still have the concern with regard to multiple defendants and that 10% threshold, or am I mixing apples and oranges
no.
on those?
As this bill reads, it says that you cannot get economic damages from an individual defendant. If an individual defendant is not more than 10% at fault, you can only get economic damages to his percent of fault. So let's say that there are 12 polluters. How do you prove? I mean, you know that he contributed to the injury. He damaged an individual, and he's damaged the state of Oregon. How do you prove that if there are 12 of them, that he put in any percentage? You may not be able to prove that it's more than 1%, but you know that his pollution was a substantial factor. I don't know. I assume Gronzo is testifying in favor of abolishing third-party practice.
It's a fairly safe assumption.
Yeah. Well, they may not. I didn't like third-party practice when it first came on the scene. It took me a while to appreciate it, but I think that when it's there have been some changes now. When it first came, what would happen is you'd get almost ready for trial and somebody would come in, file a third-party complaint, and delay on that. But we made some changes in the legislature 4 years ago, and I think when it's properly supervised by a trial judge and that, it helps wind up cases more efficiently. And
so do I hear you correctly, the fact that the Senate failed to act on that, and I don't know the status of it now. The last I heard, they were stuffing another bill and sending it over. It would probably be wise of us to not get embroiled in that battle also. We got enough fish to fry here.
I think you got a big job right here. I wouldn't abolish third-party practice, and the House took me a while to come to that, because at first it was a whole new. It's always kind of hard to go back and learn a bunch of new laws that everybody out of law school just learned, but.
Okay. Well, it just seems to me that if we fool around in that area, we could really add to the amount of litigation that's gone on.
Yeah. Well, there have been some proposals. I think in Alaska they had on joint and several a suggestion, I think they adopted that. They didn't break down between economic and non-economic damages, but they just said that a defendant would not be liable for more than his percentage if he is less than whatever the percentage was. Say, I think they used 20% at fault. And when I first heard of that, I thought that might be a sort of a simple solution of it. And then I started analyzing the situation where you really get multiple defendants. And you can't identify which one in the pollution and asbestos cases, which one caused it. And this issue was presented in Congress a few years ago, and it would have really harmed, if that had passed, it would have really harmed the ability of the federal government to reach, to recover for the cost of pollution and toxic dumps. And I think that that should be a major concern. Hope that's of some help. And thank you
very much, and thank you for your patience. Professor Vetri.
I'm Dominic Vetri, professor of law at the University of Oregon Law School. I'm here today in my individual capacity and not as a representative of the institution. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to be here. Having served on the task force, I certainly have an enhanced respect for the legislative process and the difficult position that you're in trying to make the decisions about what the public policy of the state should be. I've prepared some testimony. I'll try and summarize it and be as brief as I can. With regard to the punitive damage, wise ways, and the incapacity to bear the loss is getting even worse. About a third of our working population are uncovered with health insurance, much less disability insurance. The non-working population generally has no private health care coverage. Disability insurance coverage in the working population is a great deal more spotty and varies all over the lot in terms of adequacy. Most disability policies are extremely limited in duration and the extent of coverage. In such a situation, it's not unusual to find injured persons looking to the tort system for a means of paying their injury-related bills. Blocking off tort recovery will not, of course, eliminate those injury-related bills. They will undoubtedly result in pressure eventually for other means to cover them. The CAPS proposal, of course, does not limit economic losses, but plaintiffs rarely ever have been able to bank their non-economic loss recoveries. They have been principally used to pay the litigation expenses and attorney fees. The CAPS proposal will diminish the ability of serious injury victims to adequately maintain their personal injury rights because recoveries under such a proposal will not adequately compensate for economic losses once expenses are paid. These proposals, the CAPS bill and the Joint and Several Liability bill, take away valuable benefits that personal injury claimants have today. What are we giving them in return? It's not enough to say that pain and suffering, mental distress, humiliation, the inability to talk or receive love or affection, loss of enjoyment of life are not really compensable items in the first place. That would be contrary to the whole history of American law, both common law and statutory law, in which we have come to recognize in modern times that these elements go to the heart of what it means to be human, to the very dignity of individuals. Though the tort system recognizes these elements of compensation, we all know that the plaintiff rarely can receive the money for these losses because of the realities of litigation expenses. So even though in theory we purport to make the victim whole, in practice they really don't become whole because their litigation expenses are so high, and that they really use the non-economic loss payment as a means of financing the litigation, as a means of paying their attorney fees, and as a means of paying the litigation expenses. I would say if the legislature's intent on a CAPS proposal, then I suggest that you couple it with a requirement that the plaintiff be able to recover reasonable attorney fees in such cases. This would assure the constitutionality of the proposal under any of the constitutional clauses, and I think that would be a way to go. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Phillips.
Professor, in your written statement, do you clearly enumerate some of those amendments you talked about, specifically? I apologize for not knowing this in advance. When you talked about the lower limits for non-economic damages, has that been done before?
No.
Okay.
You mean like setting a threshold of 10,000?
Yeah.
No. Maybe that ought to be discussed. It seemed to me it would make more sense. It would affect people who are less seriously injured rather than those that are more seriously injured.
And then one other question on the...
Representative Phillips.
Thank you. The constitutionality issue of CAPS. we've been kicking around the discussion of caps, and they've had recommendations from one guy said zero to another who said 150,000 to see any effect, to one proposal of 300,000 to another of 500,000. And then the issue of that sort of escape valve, severe disfigurement, and the guy today said don't do it that way, and others have said don't do it at all, and then finally you get people that say you've got to specifically enumerate what you mean by the safety catch on this stuff, like a quadriplegic or 90% burned or paraplegic, or is that, if you have that kind of a safety valve, do you exacerbate the constitutionality question, or does it have any effect at all?
It does two things. I mean, it may help for some seriously injured victims to be able to be outside the thing would be a benefit. It probably does exacerbate the constitutionality questions, because again, now you're creating two classes, another two classes. You're people above, say, the $500,000 cap. Some of them will be able to recover full non-economic losses, and some will not. And so you have the question. For example, if I remember the escape valve that was in the task force proposal was what, serious physical impairment was one of them. What those proposals did was tend to draw a distinction between serious physical injuries as opposed to serious emotional harm. And so the court would have to trouble over whether equal that was a violation of equal protection, for the whether there were sound policy reasons rationally related to the objectives the legislature sought to achieve in distinguishing so severely between emotional harm, serious emotional harm, and serious physical injury.
If I may,
Representative Phillips.
Following on that distinction, then, and I may be the only one that holds this opinion, so I'm not speaking for anybody other than myself. It seems to me when you talk about pain and suffering issues, the non-economic issues, it's distinctly different for a minor who maybe has burned over 95% of her body and ridiculed throughout her whole life and all the garbage that goes along with it. So I was conceptually thinking of, okay, what about a segment dealing with an escape clause, if you will, for people under 12 or under 14 or whatever it might be. And from your answer, then I would say we not only set up three classes that we then put in a fourth distinction among the three classes, and that might, it doesn't make it better. Is that?
It creates an additional issue. It may eventually be sustained as a valid classification, but it would create an additional issue as to whether it was an appropriate class. You always have to keep backing up, it seems to me, and ask, what's the reason you're creating these classifications? The purported reason that I see is that it will reduce insurance rates for commercial casualty insurance. Where in the record is that demonstrated? Where does it say that? It seems to me that's a very important question that needs to be answered. If all the testimony is that it won't begin to have any impact, if it does, 4 or 5 years from now, then there's no justification for the legislation becoming effective today. It might be appropriate legislation if you wanted to think about it 5 or 6 years from now, but it's not necessarily the right thing to do today, because some people will be caught under it if it's adopted today, even though it won't be reducing insurance rates today. And the testimony that was given before the task force, none of the insurance carriers would say that adopting such legislation would reduce insurance rates in and of itself. Realistically, it can have very little effect on insurance rates in Oregon, because in order to have, say, a $300,000 or $500,000 level of non-economic losses, you have to be talking about a $1 million verdict. And I think you quoted the statistics earlier about how few $1 million verdicts there have been in Oregon. That's not where the insurance rates a problem is. The reason we have high insurance rates, if they're related to the tort claims, is the fact that we've got this vast number of accidents, most of which are for far less in damages, rather than the $1 million verdicts.
Like, just one other issue on the constitutionality issue. How can state or municipalities have a cap on payouts, but it would be unconstitutional for others too?
I think the answer there is the notion of sovereign immunity. The states traditionally were able to remove any liability whatsoever for the torts of their agents or agencies. And it's sort of the state, out of its beneficence, is saying we will accept some responsibility and some liability, but only up to this limit. And so it's different principles at play.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Further questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hanlon.
Professor Vetri, is there a difference between pain and suffering? And if so, what? Or is that a medical question rather than a legal question?
Well, I think it's a legal question because it's a legal term that we have to use to determine whether those types of damages are recoverable or not. I'm not sure that the literature or the cases try and differentiate between the two, but I thought the gentleman's answer to you earlier surely was accurate, that the physical, there's such a thing as physical pain and such a thing as mental distress or anguish. And if you wanted to, you could think of those two in those sense, that the pain could be normally thought to be much more related to actual physical injury that you're feeling, and the suffering can be more mental, emotional, rather than physical.
Further questions?
Thank you.
If not, thank you very much, and thanks for your patience this afternoon. Appreciate it very much. Further business before the subcommittee?
An announcement. Mr. Chair, Subcommittee 3 will meet almost immediately, as long as it takes for staff to get a break.
About half an hour?
No.
A couple of minutes.
Okay. So everyone will be adjourned. Sub 3 will reconvene almost immediately, as soon as it takes staff to take a break.